Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome to Politics Done Right. I am your host, Egberto Willis. Today we have a great topic on Coffee Party Radio. What is our topic of the day? Are middle class issues liberal? Is conservatism anathema to the middle class? Well, we've been having a lot of discussions about that, so I want to hear from you. Give me a call. Please give me a call. The call-in number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. When you get in, please go ahead and push 1, and I'll call on you. This is the subject we want to talk about. So come on, let's have some fun. Let's talk, let's discuss, let's do all that we need to do to come on to, you know, I think the word common ground is probably misused a bit. Common ground, common ground, common ground. What is common ground? I think we are all aware what common ground is. Common ground is where we meet at the mines, where we do things together. But here comes my little monologue, my friends. Let me start with, how was the day? It's Saturday. And what did I do today? The same old fun, but monotonous thing. Got up in the morning, checked my emails, made sure all was right with the websites. We're having a little bit of website problems right now, but did all of that. Went to buy some donuts for good old folks at Occupy Kingwood, our sustainable informational Occupy. And today we didn't have a large showing. We had a good group, though. We had a good core, and we did a lot of talking among each other. We didn't have a lot of people show up. Let me tell you, it's hot in Houston. It started off this morning when I woke up at 82 degrees. That's not the high, that's the low. And the interesting thing enough is it only went north from there. We're sitting at that corner, the sun blazing, everybody sweating, and people with their windows rolled up. It's air conditioned time. So I think most of what we're going to be doing out there is putting good signs, civil signs out, just trying to get people aware of what we think about our current body politics, what we think about programs that that we the people should be providing to we the people to make this a better country. We are going to be there for 52 weeks. We're there for 27 weeks consecutively now. 27 consecutive weeks we've gone. I am not sure, but I think if we are not the longest group doing this in the country, we're definitely one of the longest. The reality is I keep in touch with several, and I know of none that has kept this going this long. So, again, we had a very good Occupy this morning. It was not as well attended as usual. We probably had 8 or 10 people out there, and a couple had to leave early. But guess what we did? We decided that, and this comes from a lot of what we're already doing here at Coffee Party. As you know, at Coffee Party here, we have this program going, Be the Media. Remember, guys, you guys are the media. We can no longer depend on mainstream media to give us information. We can no longer depend on mainstream media to be accurate. We can no longer depend on the mainstream media to be the difference it used to be in the days of Walter Cronkite, when it actually meant something. And for the younger users or the younger listeners, I'm sorry that I brought up that name, Walter Cronkite. You guys probably want to know, who is that guy? Well, he was one of our great journalists when journalism actually meant something. But anyway, going back to what we did, we decided, a group of us, starting out with four of us, we're going to create what's known as the blog ring. What a group of us are going to do is, each of us are going to have our own domains, and they'll all be linked to my domains, and I'll talk to our board of directors here, which I'm a part of as well, to eventually, when we get things cleaned up, bring that into the circle as a method of getting a larger reach to larger communities. You know, we have the concept in Coffee Party of connecting communities. So this will drive from that sort of a thing as well. So anyway, we got together and we decided how the four of us together, each of us with our own following base, with our own ideas, are going to get together and put these blog sites together that will be interwoven, meaning it doesn't mean that one person has to come up with articles every day, though I enjoy writing so much that I can come up with 2 to 3 articles a day of what's going on out there. But I would like to have more people out here in the Coffee Party join us. I'd like to have more people doing this sort of a thing, because if our reality is going to be realized, we the media, not only we the people, but we the media, the ones that are going to do something, if that is going to be realized, we have to start somewhere, and that somewhere is right here. Right here at Coffee Party USA, where we can do in Rodney King's words, can we all get along? Anyway, getting on to the subject about what we are going to be talking about today. Of course, you guys are going to give us directions if we need to move further, but some things we want to talk about is about the lean-ins of the Coffee Party, the lean-ins of the Stratus, if you will. I titled today's show, "Are Middle Class Issues Liberal? Is Conservatism Anathema to the Middle Class?" Why did I do this subject? There is some discussion going on, civil discussion, that is, based on what we post, based on things that we say. And by the way, area code 423, I see your hands up. I'll be with you. 323 and 518, if you want to speak, when you want to speak, just please push 1 and raise your hands, and we'll get right to you as well. And people, please call in. I want this to be an active discussion. It is 646-929-2495. Give me a call. 646-929-2495. Okay, I have a feeling the 323 is Eric. Is this you, Eric?
Hey, Gberto.
How are you doing, Eric?
Doing good.
Good. Talk to me, my friend.
I'm in Camarillo, California. My family's all together. There's no internet in my Aunt Rosemary's house. She recently turned 90, and we had a great party for her. But, I haven't been able to be as good an assistant to you today as I would normally be.
Eric, I think you deserve a break every now and then. I mean, you work hard, and I don't want to kind of rub your back, but let me rub your back. Look, absent what you do, I don't know what we'd have out here. So every now and then you do need a break, buddy.
Well, I'm so glad you're doing the show today, and I'm glad you write 3 blogs a day. You can go to EgbertoWillis.com to read what is on Egberto's mind every day. And then what happens is that he shares some of his content through Coffee Party USA, and I agree, I'd love to have more people like that. But the very interesting conversation that we've been having that you were just about to bring up has really been at the heart of Coffee Party from the very beginning. So if you recall, when Coffee Party began, there was this story called the Tea Party on the news all the time. And the basic narrative was the American people have rejected the outcome of the 2008 election, And anybody who wants to stand up against that notion is a partisan. And I think there are a lot of people who just said, okay, well, I'll just be quiet here. I mean, that's a bit nutty. We just had the election. It's kind of early to reject the outcome just based on the grounds of the person we voted for didn't win. That's kind of not how we do things. And so there are a lot of people who stayed quiet. And then those people who did say something, well, they were attacked as socialist and liberal and, I don't know, whatever word you use. If you say it hatefully, you know, it's a little intimidating. They could call us great popsicles, but you know, if they say, great popsicles, you know, okay, I'll shut up. I'm sorry, I'll shut up. Don't call me a great popsicle. So then when Annabelle came forward with this way of talking about politics that says, look, we don't want to get into a hate contest with you. We're just saying that the government is not the enemy of the people. No matter who's president, the United States government is the greatest democracy or republic or democratic republic, whatever you want to call it. No reason to get hateful, but the United States government is the greatest invention ever created by humankind. And so to say we hate it and we want to destroy it just because the person we voted for president didn't win is absurd. And to be obstructionist and to be fact-free and to be hyper-partisan in your obstruction, you know, in your opposition to progress for this country, just because your candidate didn't win, it's truly, I mean, it's, well, let's just say it's not productive.
You know, Eric, I'm glad you said that. I just hold that thought. I'm so glad you said that because what you said there was so important. We have created the best government on the planet. How then can any of us then turn and hate it? Okay, I'm sorry. Just needed to reiterate that. Continue, please.
Okay, well, and so I think the genius of Annabelle's snowy video. And I was there. I saw all the outtakes as well as the stuff that we put into it. But essentially what she's saying is, look, we can participate in our national political discourse without deserving hatred. And here's how. We're just going to be fact-based. We're just going to be solutions-oriented. We're just going to be transpartisan. We're going to be as, you know, as hateful as the Tea Party is, we're going to be inviting and inclusive and respectful. And if you're going to call that socialist, then we're just going to accept it. We're not going to be intimidated into silence. You can call us those names. And, you know, like Berta, you said something on the Coffee Party Board of Directors call that I really related to. And I think it's part of the reason why Annabelle has the kind of civic courage that she has is related to what you said. Annabelle, of course, was born in South Korea. Her grandfather was abducted by North Korea, and they never saw him again. Her family has been completely, you know, torn apart by a civil war over political ideology, really not over anything else, right? Mm-hmm. And so when she sees one part of our country, and, you know, let's face it, the Tea Party was a tiny fragment of Fox News watchers. You know, I mean, it was maybe half of Fox News' audience, but Fox News' audience is, you know, 3% of the population. They were on TV a lot. That's true. And we definitely, you know, they influenced policy. But when Annabelle saw that, and people said, well, that's too scary, I don't want to participate in the political process because those people are scary, or they're going to call me names, Annabelle's like, oh, come on. If that's what you're afraid of, I've seen a heck of a lot worse. And if we allow people who organize around hatred to keep taking more and more and more of our civic space and more of the conversation, things can get a heck of a lot worse because she's seen it, even though she was little. She's seen it. And so you actually, Berta, said something when, you know, we were on the call, I think it was just a few days ago, right?
Right.
And we were saying, God, but, you know, we're going to get called this if we say that. And, you know, people are going to criticize us. And what did you say, Berto?
Well, Let me see if I remember the one that I said. I said several things about the middle class, and I said one of the specific things that I know that I said is that we have to simply tell the truth. You know, but I don't know if there's another part that you meant of my conversation.
Well, I'm going to say your line, and then you can expand on it. You said,
okay.
You said, ladies and gentlemen, I am the only one on this call whose house has been firebombed. And
oh, that one. Yes, 423, I'm going to get to you in a minute. I usually don't. I brought that up because I wanted to say, look, I am not scared of anything. And if there is somebody that had something to be scared about, I've actually gone through some of that. And what I wanted to say is that, and again, I don't bring that subject up a lot, because the one thing you don't want people to think is you're using things to seem like a victim, because that I'm not. I'm not a victim. I actively go out and I'm an activist. We are activists. We go out there and we do what's best, what we think our fellow citizens need. But that occurred. We got pretty. When my daughter went off to college, I felt free enough in my community, which is a very conservative community, to start putting my views out there where I thought they needed to be. And in doing so, I pretty much get quite a bit of hate mail. I get quite a bit of on the different Kingwood area websites. There are a lot of places where my name is mud. So, I mean, I take that, but it's just a matter of if you know what you're doing is right, and you don't feel yourself in physical your safety in danger, real danger, I think it's incumbent upon us as citizens to do it. When you say, when you look at what Annabelle's people went through, it's nothing like what we are going through here. Yeah, we have some crazies out here as well. But still, it's nothing like what you see out there. So if we don't want to be like what's out there, we have to do what we're doing here now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take the call, and then I'm going to try to give voice to some of our fellow board members who are legitimately concerned, even though they may not call in today. We definitely want to make sure our callers and our members especially know that there is this conversation going on within the Coffee Party leadership, that, you know, as we get closer to 2012, it's hard to talk about politics without taking a side or being perceived as taking a side. And so what do we do?
Exactly. Let me go ahead then. Eric, I'm keeping you on, and I'm going to bring in area code 423. 423, hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, good sir.
And who am I speaking to?
My name is Brian.
Brian, thank you very much for calling. What's your last name, Brian? A lot of times we get more than one, Brian.
Anthus.
Okay, great. How you doing?
Let I'm doing
me hear
well.
What you have to say, my friend.
Well, what I wanted to actually rewind back to is what Eric was saying about, you know, the U.S. being one of the greatest, you know, experiments as far as government's concerned. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely true, and I'm most concerned with, honestly, what is going on as far, well, for example, like I just read an article recently, and the article was talking about, you know, historically, you know, when Congress, you know, first got together and we had, you know, a certain population and a certain amount of representatives, once we had maxed out the number of representatives that we have now, the percentage, I mean, the ratio of citizens to representatives was a lot smaller than it is today. So now, for example, there might be like 1 million people, whereas before there may have been 1,000. That's just an extreme example. I can't remember the exact numbers. So
right.
I think that that's one thing, is our representatives are just so far detached from what's actually going on. And then number two, what I'm really concerned about is campaign finance reform, because I think that the reason that, you know, the middle class is getting so squashed is because we have a smaller voice proportionally when it comes to campaign finance. You know, of course, you know, in the Supreme Court decision, they basically said, oh, well, you know, money is speech. So that means that even though there's tons and tons of us out there, we don't have any money. You know, if you look and see who has the money and who doesn't, the top, you know, earners and wealth owners, they have the money, so they have the speech. So they're, you know, having disproportionate influence in the political process. So I think it would be great, like, for example, if there were individual contribution limits that were even smaller than what they are now. Also wish that corporations, nonprofits, any type of organization would be barred from actually spending that money into campaign finance, and instead maybe just have like a public system where there's just X amount of dollars that are earmarked for that, and that way it's more egalitarian. What are your thoughts?
That is excellent, sir. That is excellent, and you're so right. I think if more people were to focus on that particular issue, we would have no problem when it comes to finance. But let me ask you something, because you are quite knowledgeable in several things that you know afflict the country when it comes to things like campaign finance reform and so forth. The problem is a lot of average Americans, they're busy, they work a lot. They don't quite understand these things. Now, when we go against these things, when we go against some of these policies, we're accused, and this is something that Eric was talking about, because going against campaign finance reform, going for campaign finance reform, going for controlling how money is spent in politics, et cetera, have a tendency to be labeled by some left. Others don't even know anything about that. How would you tell us that we could reach people on common ground and not necessarily left or right to look at that issue and do something about it?
I mean, that's a good question. And honestly, I think that that's the root of the problem, is that there's not really a simple answer. A lot of these problems are very complex. And it kind of reminds me of like Ross Perot back in the day when Clinton was running. And he gets out these charts and people just, their eyes glaze over and they fall asleep. So I don't think there really necessarily is a simple answer. I know that there's a lot of, you know, nonprofits out there, you know, that are always crunching the numbers and trying to release information on this type of stuff. But mostly it's just policy wonks that are, like, interested in what that stuff is, and journalists, so that they can write a good story. So I don't know what the answer is. I just know it's a problem. It'd be great to fix it. I mean, I try and talk to my friends about it, you know, that actually do care and are engaged in stuff like this. But, I mean, I have a hard enough time just getting people to register to vote.
Right. Now, why do you think this is because, okay, right now, our main subject today was supposed to be left to right. But you're bringing in some issues here that I really want to weave into the subject as well. You said sometimes you even have a hard time getting people to vote. Why do you think it is that people have the feeling like it doesn't matter? Do you think they have the feeling like they're just two extremes on the other side and nobody thinks about what do you feel deep on the inside is the problem?
Well, you know, I'm a private citizen, but I'm also a public sector employee. And one of the things that I have to do every time I see a client is I have to offer them the opportunity to register to vote if they want to. And that's actually one of my most rewarding parts of my job, because I love to help people get registered to vote. You know, I like feel so fulfilled from doing that. I would do that for free, and I do sometimes on my own time. And usually the type of comments the public gives me outside of my friends is, oh, who cares, or, oh, both these people are worthless, or anyway. I get a lot of those, you know, apathetic type of responses.
Right. I mean, so there you go. Now, and the next question then is, when you get that kind of response, how do you handle it? What do you tell them?
Well, if I'm at work, I don't say anything. I just smile and let them sign their declination form and keep on rolling. If mm-hmm. I'm, you know, in my capacity as a private citizen, you know, talking to a friend or a colleague or, you know, some other acquaintance, I'll try to engage them and explain to them. But a lot of times what they'll tell me, honestly, like, I mean, all anybody cares about right now is jobs and money. That's really all people are caring about when I talk to them. And everything mm-hmm. else is just under the surface. Now, I do have a few foreign friends. And, you know, immigration reform and this, you know, presidential announcement has, like, been the big talk amongst a lot of my friends.
Right.
But in general, and I'm a younger American, too. So, I mean, most of my friends just don't care. That's the problem I see.
Right. It's interesting that they don't care, but some of the biggest problems right now is actually going to affect them, not people, let's say, my age. you know, in middle-aged folks are probably still okay, but the Generation X, then Generation Z, we are the ones that are blowing up this society for them. We are the one that's destroying this society for you guys. If you get my drift. In other words, we are here. Well, when I say we, I'm talking about a generation, but we are here fighting silly battles of left and right. We are here fighting silly battles of whether America should join the nations that where their citizens can have good health care, whether Americans can join a nation, can join where people in the middle class can feel that they have access to move up. You know, these are the things. Like I tell my daughter is in Austin at in doing some pre-med stuff, and I told her. So I remember there were times that she wondered why am I such a zealous with the politics, with what's going on? Why is it that we're so engulfed in this? And I looked at her the other day, and I told her, actually, because of you. I mean, when I'm gone, you are the one that's going to have to live with this mess. Yeah. So, I mean, I'd like to leave as little mess as possible. And not only, there's a time every next generation did better. I did better than my parents. My parents did better than their parents. You know, I mean, it progressively got better. But now I don't see that. I don't see that the other that your generation, which I imagine you could be my kid, your generation is doing better than we are. Eric, you want to chime in here some?
Sure, so many things. Brian, thanks for that really excellent analysis. I mean, we also came to the conclusion that campaign finance reform is the most important goal. We also feel that tax code reform and Wall Street reform are actually intricately related. You said that people care most about jobs and job creation and economic issues. And truly, I think one of the most important things we can do is to shift the national narrative on things like jobs. So whatever it is that the country is talking about, let's talk about jobs for a second. We need to shift the narrative away from this idea that the only job creators in this country are people who are already millionaires. In fact, it's people who were born millionaires. The only job creators in America, they say, are the people who already have a lobbying firm, the ones who are trying to protect their wealth. The only job creators in America are the ones who have designer tax codes right now so that they pay way, way less of our collective, you know, crowdsourced money that we call the federal fund. They pay way, way less than they did when our country was strong, when the middle class was growing. They've rigged it over the last 30 years so that we, the non-born millionaires, have to pay a larger share of the federal fund. We have to pay more taxes. And if we can't quite make up the difference for what the people who were born millionaires have rigged for them to pay, basically they're paying less. They've been paying less and less over the last 30 years. If we can't make up the difference, then we have a deficit and too bad. And if the government doesn't function well enough because of these deficits, well, too bad. Let's just destroy the government. So I think that another way of talking about job creators would be more in terms of historical fact. Because the historical fact is it wasn't the millionaires and billionaires who created jobs over time. It was the millions and millions of people, so many more people, just trying to Okay, let me just finish this. Okay, I'm sorry. Millions of people just trying to get by, just trying to start a business, just trying to excel, live the American dream. That is what's always lifted this country up. And you know, we've had this fight over and over again, but this is the first time we've had it where there's this tremendous advantage that the ruling class has in communications technology. Now, the last 6 years, we've been catching up a little bit with the Internet, but for the 25 years before that, with the end of the Fairness Doctrine and with the creation of these gigantic partisan media conglomerates like the Fox News Network and Rush Limbaugh's radio network, what's happened is that many Americans have unfortunately come to accept notions like the only job creators are people who were born millionaires. We need to do something using, you know, technology like this, Blog Talk Radio, that doesn't require the millions of dollars to start up, you know, actually doesn't require much at all to start up. But because there are millions and millions of us, and there are only a handful of families that think it's their entitlement to rule this country, I think in the end we're going to have to win, but we need to do it sooner, because a lot of damage has been done in the last 30 years, and there's still more damage to be done if we allow these economic loyalists to run our government much longer.
That is absolutely and so true. And you know, in trying to find what is difficult, Eric, and I think Brian could attest to this, is in trying to find the solution to all these problems, it is almost like what has been done is we've created a lot of false battles so that we can't really get to the problems at hand. Let's just look at the subject that we had here. You know, let's look at some of the stuff that I write, that you write, that we put on our main Facebook page and the website, where we talk about issues that are for the, you know, that are there to protect the middle class, that are there to ensure that the middle class remains, that are there to assist the poor get access to being in the middle class. Why is it, instead of fighting those battles on the merits of those battles, do we have to fight them on left and on the left and right divide? Create a lot of false battles so that we can't get to the core of the real issues. You want to chime in on that, Brian?
Oh, sure. I guess, you know, as you were saying that, I had two words going through my mind. I was thinking, you know, Karl Rove and wedge issues. You know, a lot of these political operatives, they're not just a, you know, single Karl Rove out, but, you know, political operatives on both sides of the aisle, you know, have become almost, you know, I don't know, virtuosos when it comes to, like, orchestrating and dealing with these type of issues when it comes to local races, trying to find something that'll get somebody riled up that keeps a distraction going on. And that's why, you know, the middle class is being robbed today, is because we're too busy worrying about a million other little things that in the end really probably don't matter.
That is so true. And that is true. That is difficult to accept because, you know, it is like, and by the way, for callers for people that are calling, when you want to talk, please just push the button, push the one, hit one, so that I can see that you want me to bring you live in. Again, let me give my number again. It is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. We're discussing several issues here. We're currently speaking to Brian. Go ahead and continue, Brian.
Sure. I guess the thing, you know, to get to the main subject that you're trying to talk about, I think mostly was about the inequality. I wanted to just, you know, bounce off of what Eric was saying a few moments ago. And that is, you know, when it comes to these job creators, you know, not necessarily always being millionaires, I agree with that. I actually think that, honestly, entrepreneurship is usually the small business. I read an article the other day that said that most startups begin with less than $100, you know. These are the type of people we need to be supporting. We need to be supporting people that are, you know, pursuing advanced degrees, that are, you know, pursuing any degree for that matter, people that are willing to work hard, you know, whether or not it's an immigrant or someone that was born here naturally or whatever. And we need to try and support these people so that they can actually create the jobs that we need. I know that's almost counterintuitive, because a lot of times we hear, you know, that, oh, well, if we allow, you know, immigration reform to go forward, then that's going to take away a job from a natural-born U.S. citizen. And I don't think that that's always necessarily the case, because, I mean, when you sit down and look at the numbers, I mean, that isn't what's going on.
Right. There are two issues there. And first, let me first qualify this. I'm an immigrant. I'm originally from Central America. I came over here when I was 18 years old to go to college. I came, got, I stayed here, got a job, and then eventually formed my own company. And, you know, again, never been a steward of the government. That said, when I wrote a blog about outsourcing a few days ago, I think it was, and one of my guys that follows me on Facebook said, when I was complaining about the amount of jobs being outsourced, he started to bring up that, well, you know, there are other companies that bring jobs to the United States, and they build foreign cars out here now. Suppose those other countries took a stance. To which I said, look, I don't really have a problem with us having stuff built overseas. It's all about balance. It's even, you know, when we talk about the right-left divide, all of this is about balance. I don't expect to get everything that I want, and I don't think anybody that used to be in the sensible right in the past did believe they would get everything they want. We all have our philosophies. We all have our ideologies. We all think, you know, there are certain things that are core. It's not wrong. There are certain things that are absolute truths. There are certain things that are cultural, that there's no wrong or right. I mean, if we can come in between, that would be fine. But going back to the job creators that you were talking about, when you said who are the real job creators and so forth, it's so important. And this is a very essential issue. It goes to the left-right divide, and it also goes directly to the core of the middle class. And it goes this way. Let's look at Mr. Romney. Mr. Romney, in saying that, and I shouldn't single out Mr. Romney, I should also include others. But I am going to hold my point, because there's another caller that's, I think, has been on, and I want to get this person on, and then I'll get back to the job creator discussion. Person at 603, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Michael Egberto. How are you?
Michael, how are you doing, sir? Is this Marco Tierney?
Yes, it is.
Oh, great. Thank you for calling in, Michael. Great to have you here.
Thank you. You're welcome. I heard the word sensible right, and I thought that was my cue.
That is absolutely your cue, and I hope what I said in bringing in the sensible right and the balance and so forth, it is something that we both agree on, because, you know, we've discussed some of this, I think, in the past.
We do. And, you know, I've been listening to the show since just about the beginning, and sitting here at my desk doing very middle class things like paying the mortgage and re-registering my car and balancing my checkbooks. So there are, I'm sure, some out there who don't believe that Republicans actually are in the middle class anymore, but many of us are.
Hey, man, it's great to have you here. Why don't you say a little bit about your piece, given that you're listening to what we've been talking thus far?
I think I've said this many times before, that the issues around campaign finance reform and the sort of bigger story about money and politics in general really shouldn't be thought of as a right and left issue or a conservative and liberal issue. It should be considered a right and wrong issue. I mean, I feel very strongly that there's, you know, one person, one vote, not $1, one vote. And I think that that's not really, I think it's been unfairly construed as a liberal conservative issue. And, you know, Eric, I don't know if you're still on, Eric, but Eric made the point a few minutes ago that, or maybe it was you, Egberto, made the mm-hmm. point a few minutes ago that, you know, perhaps it's false. There's sort of a falseness about, oh no, it was Eric. He was talking about the 1% media and how they drive a narrative that really creates a wedge and really creates sort of black and white conservative
right.
versus liberal issues, when in fact things are much more complex than that. And the vast majority of there's been a lot of studies done. The vast majority of Americans have far more complex views than what would be evidenced by either listening to a Rush Limbaugh or, you know, my favorite example on the other side, an Ed Schultz,
right.
sometimes a Keith Olbermann, but he's not around so much anymore.
Right.
And these are, you know, the actual definition of conservative, I don't think is really valid anymore, the one that's in the conventional wisdom. I don't think conservatism has any is in any way orthogonal to the idea of being in the middle class. I think historically many, many, many large chunks of the middle class have been conservatives and probably still are. The it seems to me that the narrative has driven people to, or the narrative has driven middle class conservatives to reject in some ways what is economically to their own benefit in favor of the socially conservative story that's being driven down their throat. I don't know if you're familiar with Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Or the movie
that came out. It's basically that story, right? Many, many people are voting against their own interests in favor of the social conservative agenda that they believe will be driven by conservatives when they win, which simply historically isn't really all that true.
Never true. It's funny that right now I'm supporting a candidate here in Kingwood. He's running in District 127. And what's interesting about it is we had a fundraiser for him yesterday, and he gave and in as much as I'm a humanist, but this guy is a devout Christian young man, and he gave the most, and I have it on video that I'm going to put on my website, because the reason I brought up that I'm a humanist is that he gave a true Jesus Christ stump speech, things that I know he believes in because I've known him for a long time. But the way he articulated it, it kind of makes you say, this is one person I have to vote for because he has my values. He has my values, and I know he has all the values in the communities. And not only that, what he stood for was middle-class values. And yet, most believes he doesn't stand a chance because of where he lives. And to put it in your context, why then would people listen to what he has to say? And I'm not actually saying all the things that he said, but why are people listening to what he has to say? The other guy that's running against him is my old racquetball partner or buddy. How can they look at these two candidates and one is going to win simply because he goes out and he says, guess what? I'm a Republican conservative. I got your vote. Make any sense?
No, it doesn't make any sense. But there are, well, I shouldn't say that. For me, it doesn't make sense. Right. I have always been, and you know, many of my friends are, actually I have friends across the spectrum, but you know, a lot in the moderate middle who vote for candidates. Right? So they look at a particular candidate and they say, does this candidate match my values? Do they want what I want? And because I'm a moderate, it's a lot less black and white.
Republican. Yeah, go ahead.
But there are. And I've heard really cogent arguments for voting ideologically. And forget whether or not the ideology is crazy, and I think the far right ideology has just gone over the deep end. But there are people who say it's a mistake to vote for the candidate, because ultimately what ends up being elected in Washington is a group of people that must work together. And any one individual, the one politician who really makes a difference, is rare. I mean, you know, most people can't even name their own senators or their own congressmen. And if you go back through history and ask, you know, or ask anybody around you to name, you know, 5 or 10 really significant political figures who had an impact, I think a lot of people have difficulty with that once you get past sort of an FDR and maybe, you know, a Lyndon Johnson with civil rights. You don't get a lot of that. So because of that, there are people who argue that you should vote ideology. You should vote so that the ideas that you want that will come to the fore at a party level, and it really doesn't matter about the individual because that individual is going to be subsumed within his party. So you should, in fact, vote for the party because you want the party's general ideology to be the one that dominates in the country. And that's a legitimate argument. I happen not to agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who vote, you know, they vote a party line. My parents did it growing up. I mean, they didn't even know who they were voting for. They just checked off every Democrat on the list.
Right. Now, interesting. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. You weren't.
No. That was what I want to say.
Yeah. Interesting enough. I disagree with the voting. Well, voting. Just saying that voting party or ideology is the ideal solution because individuality doesn't matter. I think behind the scenes, much of what we don't see, I would almost wager that individual politicians really do make a difference. And behind the backdoor negotiations, that there are some with strong characters who actually get listened to. Don't you think?
Oh, I agree. You're preaching to the converted here, if I can use a conservative analogy.
Right.
So, for example, it would make a real difference to me if, and I'll use Olympia Snowe as an example. She's in a neighboring state, and I think she's one of the best Republicans to be elected to office in many, many years. She's unfortunately retiring because she can't take it anymore, along with several others. But if you gave me the choice between an Olympia Snowe and a much further right candidate, then I would always choose the Olympia Snowe based on the personal characteristics.
Right.
If you gave me the option of choosing a slightly left of center Democrat, a moderate Democrat, such as Governor Lynch, the Democratic governor of New Hampshire, if he were to ever run for state office, federal office, and a very, very far right wing, say a Tea Party, I hate to use that because Tea Party's.
I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean. I would likely go for the moderate Democrat, because I agree with you. Maybe I'm still voting ideologically, but it's an ideology of one, and I'm looking for the person who maps to the ideology that I have, not to the party ideology. But there are arguments that says that, like I say, I've heard good arguments, logical arguments on the other side.
Right.
I prefer my view, and I agree with yours. We have the same view here.
Excellent. Brian, you want to chime in on that? Brian is one of our younger listeners, and he had some pretty great ideas. You want to chime in on that, Brian?
Oh, sure. I was actually thinking the same thing, preaching to the choir. I was hoping you could rewind and go back. You were going to say something about job creators and immigration. I was hoping you were going to expound on that.
Let me go back there. Let me tell you a little bit of history. This is what I was going to talk about, because it really one of the things, and here I'm going to have to plug my book. And before I do that, let me go to Michael. Michael, please tell everybody listening. Michael Cherney is an author, and he has a great book out there. Michael, go ahead and let us know what that is.
I didn't call in for the plug, but I'll take advantage of it. It's called Chasing Glenn Beck, A Personal Experiment in Reclaiming Our Hijacked Political Conversation. And it's fundamentally about what has happened to political dialogue in America as the extremists have taken away the microphones from the rest of us. And one of the reasons I joined Coffee Party USA and decided to participate at the level that I am is frankly for the opportunity to get back part of that microphone, to get part of that bandwidth, and be a voice for moderation.
Well, thank you very much for stating that, Michael. And by the way, don't feel too bad, because I had to use your book as a moderating factor to the title of my own. Okay, but anyway, going back to the question at hand to Brian, a year and a half ago, I wrote a book called As I See It, Class Warfare, the Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom. And there's no violence or anything like that. It was simply a well-annotated book of facts, not only facts, but also my personal ideology as far as how I thought there should be the separation between the individual, the corporation, and the government, and how they should all work together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I mentioned about job creators earlier with you. I have a small software company. I remember when starting this company, I went to the bank to get a $40,000 loan, and that is when $40,000 was a lot of money. Okay? What happened then is they laughed at me and just laughed me out of the door. I went on with no money, just credit cards, to build a company. And what did my company do? Write software, sell software over the internet. But in the process, I bought services from a local printer who printed books. I bought services for the web. In those days, it wasn't a website, it was bulletin boards. We're talking about 20 years ago or so, about 20 years ago. And there's just a whole lot of services this one-man shop purchased. In other words, I had a product to sell, and in order to sell that product, I required the services of many other small companies to provide the goods and services, the hardware, the paper, all that good stuff. Now, I got no tax advantage in my interest rates that I paid on my credit card loans because, again, it was consumer loan. I got no benefits of any type. Now we have those of what I call the titans of finance. The titans of finance would have seen a company, let's say like my own, and would have said, wow, we see value in there. By the way, these titans of finance, they get tax breaks. They pay lower taxes because what are they? They're investors. They are job creators. They would come to companies like mine, or others, where our sweat, our blood, our pains, our rice and beans instead of steak was used to create something of value to society. My products are using gas. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I know this may be kind of harsh, but I mean, this almost sounds like wage slavery or almost like a modern version of sharecropping or something, you know, the way that the small middle class is being treated, you know, and I know that sounds extreme to say, but that I think that may be something that you're trying to allude to potentially.
Let me tell you, my friend, you are wise beyond your years. Let me tell you, if you go back to our coffee party site or coffee party web page, and please, I don't know if you're a part of coffee party or not, but we do need people like you to be a part of the fold. So please go ahead and consider doing so if you're not. But I wrote a piece called Indentured. I don't remember the exact name, but it had in its title Indentured Servitude. And the reason I spoke about indentured servitude is that is what the middle class has become, indentured servants. And this is what is hurtful about this whole situation is to somehow make this a right and left divide. It is not a right or left divide. It's a have not, have too much, have none. That is what we're talking about. But you see, if we can channel this into an argument of left and right. Look, Michael Cherney was just on with us. Michael Cherney is a Republican, okay? I love to listen to what Michael Cherney has to say. I'm a liberal Democrat, but I genuinely like to listen to Michael Cherney when he talks. He makes sense to me. Now, I am pretty sure he's more conservative than I am in that he probably wants less government than I do. But I can almost guarantee you as well that after we were to dialogue about, well, who are the real job creators, and if I were to say my piece and come out against some of the issues with how the capital markets are treated differently than what I would want to call the middle class market, I think I would give guys like Michael and any other thinking Republican some thought. And they may say, well, Egberto, I think that is right. But since my fear is an overbearing government, where can we come together to mitigate what you are talking about, or what people in my spectrum's talking about, with my core beliefs being, I know Michael would probably say that it'll be best if he had said it himself, he doesn't hate government, but he just prefers a system where the government plays a very small role. I don't. But that, like I said before, there are certain things that are right and certain things that are wrong, but there are certain things it's just about neither right or wrong. It's just what you want. I like larger government with a bigger safety net. He does not. Is that wrong or right? I don't think it is. It is about what kind of a society that you want. Now, back again at hand to the jobs creators. We have allowed a narrative since Reagan, and I hate to only say since Reagan, because our current right, and this is where I really hoped some more Republicans would call in, our current right makes Reagan look pretty left, because he was the guy who came out and said things that none of these guys, you would hear any one of these guys talking about, you know, you wouldn't hear these guys talking about, and these are very important issues. You know, these are not only important to the middle class, I actually think these are issues that are important to the survival of the country. I was doing some study a few months ago when I wrote a piece called, something about the middle class. It was a holding the middle class hostage. That was one of the articles that I wrote. And it had to do, and when I was doing that paper, I remembered looking up at some numbers and looking at things that have happened what happened in 1929, and then trying to look at the parallels with what's happening today. And what you saw is that wealth disparity and that income disparity that we have today is pretty much mimicking what we had then. And what that kind of tells you, and, you know, it's not, this is, you know, economics is not completely scientific, but you can actually see the direction that certain behaviors create. And if you take a look at what happened in 1929, when the middle class had that much less to spend relative to the upper classes, what you saw is that the economy as we knew it was unsustainable. Which is what we're seeing now. Why can't we create a whole lot of jobs? And even the jobs that are being created today, why is it that the wages are so low comparatively? That wage disparity, that income disparity, that these laws that are biased towards the 1%. I hate to say the 1% because people go crazy when you say, oh, you're trying to create division. It's not division.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, please, sir. Please
I was just going to say, I think that that's the heart of the issue, is not just jobs, but it's actually good quality middle-class jobs. There's that void there. There's a lot of people – you know, I graduated from college in 2009. I'm actually a graduate student, and I'm also a full-time employee. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm very fortunate, but a lot of people I graduated with, they're either back in grad school, living with their parents, in law school, in tons of debt. Most of them that have jobs have terrible jobs, or they're living with their parents, or they don't have a job at all. And, I mean, you know, 08, 09 was not a good time to graduate, obviously, you know. But that's the problem that we're experiencing today. It's not necessarily that there's just a void of just jobs, period. Because, I mean, if I lost my job, you know, I would apply for unemployment that day. But I would also go find a job that isn't necessarily fun, just like I did when I was in college, you know. I'm not scared to do that. But having said that, when you go and try and find, you know, a professional entry-level job or just a middle-class job for someone that's been experienced, I mean, they're just in short supply.
You know, that is so right. And you see, Brian, all of this is simply policy. You know, nobody wants to accept that. These are policy issues that if you can get into policy and forget about politics. Unfortunately, the policy that would need to be instituted to resolve these types of problems, again, and I would like Eric to chime in, I have to look at that policy from a left side view just because it's not embraced by the right side, and the right side calls it all these different. Let me give you some specific examples. Outsourcing. Okay, people say, whenever I hear a politician say, if we would make our tax systems different so that all those guys that have made all these millions in profits from the middle class here in the United States who have parked their monies overseas through different financial machinations in our tax code, if those guys, when I say they're holding the middle class hostage, I mean they're keeping all this cash offshore with the expectation that they will get a government that will tell them, okay, you can repatriate that money into America at next to nothing in taxes or maybe tax-free. Now, when we talk about outsourcing, again, where we have policies that don't penalize a person who is making a lot of products out of the country that then re-import them at beneficial rates. In other words, why would I allow an American company to make a whole lot of trinkets in China and then import them back to the United States and claim, well, since they are, you know, they're made for the American market or whatever, we don't have these high tariffs on them. I mean, it's all the incentive to keep production out of the United States and make this particular profit from all of this go to the top, the people who own these companies. And who are the people who own these companies or the majority shareholders in these companies? The upper 1%. And a lot of people would like to say, but, you know, everybody in their 401k, they own IBM stocks. They own all these. Yes, but they own such a small percentage of it. Numbers don't lie. When we look at, we tell you, I know in my, in the back of my book, and this is where I mention it, I had this stuff that said, and it's changed substantially since in that 1 year, says the wealth in this country is unevenly distributed to the top 5% and 1%, not because they are more productive or produce anything of lasting value to society, but because of the structural design of our capitalist society, rewarding capital manipulation more so than producing goods and services of societal value. Keep these numbers in your thoughts, and remember, they've changed. The top 1% of the population owns 34% of the nation's wealth. The top 5% owns 60% of the nation's wealth. The top 10% owns 71% of the nation's wealth. Top 20 owns 85%. The bottom 40% own less than 1%. You look at those numbers, right? What it tells you immediately, those numbers tell you immediately, it doesn't matter what anybody tells you on TV about everybody has a vested interest in the stock market. No, they don't. They don't. The reality is a lot deeper. The reality is we are becoming a country where we have the semblance of a middle class, because as long as you make some income that can take you to Burger King, take you to a movie every so often, take your wife out to Cancun ever so often, you're okay. But we have no idea that, you know, you get sick, you're bankrupt. I mean, fortunately, only probably 20 or 30% of people are going to get real sick in their lifetime before they die. But it is so bad. The problem is that people are able to rig the message in such a manner that, yes, you, sir, don't see what is actually going on. They rig the message in such a manner that you don't see it. And that's why it's so important. And I've mentioned this several times. This is why it is so important for when you see it's Coffee Party develop something like You Be the Media, the Be the Media campaign. And so for why it's so important for us to go out there and tell another story. But our problem here sometimes at Coffee Party is that in telling that story, it would give the indication that we are, well, just another, let's say, left-wing organization, which is not so. Again, everybody got a chance to listen to Michael Cherney, somebody who is right of center, and he acknowledges the problem. He sees the problem. But we need what a lot on the right have been able to do is completely give a large and continuing narrative everywhere, all of the times. And what we have to do is be able to give truthful, factual narratives all the time. We can't do it everywhere because we don't own radio stations. We don't own TV stations. But luckily for us, people your age, Brian, what they love to do is they get most of their news from going to blogs, going to the internet, going to every now and then getting on, watching, what's his name? John Stewart. that's what they do. Oh, Eric, why don't you chime in?
Well, okay, you ever so much. I mean, the one thing I wanted to say was that when a few families and a few
you're kind of breaking up, Eric.
Controlling so much of the world and controlling so much of the media content that reaches large numbers of people, then what happens is just becomes a cycle of corruption. And, you know, you're about to talk about Mitt Romney. Michael and I were talking about him a few days ago.
Eric, you're breaking up some.
Oh, okay. Come back to me in a second. I'll get a place in a better area.
No problem. Brian,
I want to ask you. I want to ask you a couple things real quick because you just said a lot. First thing is, as far as you know, public policy and you know, discussion. You know, something that I think that wouldn't even cost the U.S. government really hardly anybody that they could help the middle class with when it comes to health care. In my opinion, and maybe this could be a bipartisan thing that maybe both sides of the aisle could agree on. You know, when you look at personal bankruptcies, the number one reason is because of health care issues. That's the number
Absolutely.
One reason. And so I would like to just see, some law passed that would just make it, they're not allowed to use, health care related expenses in your credit score or on your credit report. I think that would be a huge boost. I mean, I know, the healthcare industry probably wouldn't like that, but I think that would be something, as far as a middle class safety net, that would be, innovative, outside the box type, response. I'm curious what you think about that. And I'm also curious, because you were talking just a second ago, about, hard work and education, stuff like that. Do you actually think, do you think that with hard work and education and all of these things that, were ingrained in our head at a young age forward, that if we do these things that we can actually get ahead in America still? What are your thoughts on those two issues?
Okay, let me take it in order. As far as your thing about not affecting the credit score, you know what that would do? I mean, you're correct. You're so correct about that is thinking outside of the box. And guess what? I had not heard that one before. And while I got the gist of it when you were talking, I was thinking, what are the ramifications? What are the there's a word that people use when they want to say that you're creating the opportunity for people to take advantage of it. There's a phrase that
moral hazard.
Moral hazard. I started to think, what would be the moral hazard of such a thing, right?
And, oh yeah, there's always unintended consequences.
Exactly. So while you were talking about it, I started to think about that, and then I said, but you know what? That could be actually regulated. In other words, what I'm saying is, yes, it not be a part of your credit score, so it shouldn't affect certain things, but still, yet that the company charging you have some recourse. I mean, I think the law could be written in such a manner that would actually work. But not only so, but I think, believe it or not, that could actually force prices in that people would say, well, in order to avoid all that trouble, maybe if we made it a bit more, meet them a little closer in the middle, we won't even have to go to court. And so, no, there is a lot of value to doing something like that, as I see it. Eric could chime in a little later on that. On the second item that you spoke about, whether, first of all, I'm going to give you the straight answer, no. And this is what I mean by no. My daughter's in college right now, and I had a 529 for her, and there's still a bit of money in the 529 for her to get through her 4 years, and maybe a bit for her postgraduate work. But the reality is, let's say absent what we've spent on her, which so far it's probably over a hundred and change in the last three years, 100 and change thousand in her last 3 years. If she did that on her own, she would have started whatever job she had in the hole. So she would be working to pay back creditors for some time. Like my sister, is a pediatrician. Her husband is a civil engineer. The two of them are still paying their student loans off. So, I mean, so what I'm saying is we have already created a culture where the bankers first, when you bought your house, you owed them. Now when you go to school, you owe them. What else are you going to owe them for? And how did these things come about? Because the tax base is so low that your kids and everybody else pay more for education. You pay more as a percentage for all these different things. And because you're paying more for all these different things and you don't make that increase in cost, that you haven't increased your wages consummate to the value of things, what then happens is that you borrow, you know,
and you can't even discharge your loans in bankruptcy either.
And you know what? That was another that stuff about not being able to discharge.
Loans.
Right. You're so true about that. Again, policy. Again, my friend, policy. That policy was made. And by the way, the Skype caller, I will be getting to you shortly. That was policy created to ensure that the bank never loses. Remember, even when we had the crash, the bank never loses. Even now that they've downgraded all these banks, all I could do was laugh because people look at the downgrade as something bad for the banks, right? Let me ask you guys to take a look at something that happened. The banks got downgraded on Thursday. What happened on Friday? Their stocks went up. Do you know why?
Did they get an infusion of capital from the Federal Reserve? I didn't read the story, but I'm just
assuming
that's what
happened.
Stuck.
Let me tell you. First of all, what that downgrade did is it gave them carte blanche to increase interest rates on consumers. So we again are going to pay. Okay? It gives the excuse that they will be able to use for the consumer is that, hey, we got downgraded and our borrowing costs are higher. But guess who they borrow from? They borrow from either the Federal Reserve or themselves, right? Interbanking, borrowing, and so forth, and they're downgrade. It's not like he only downgraded a few of the majors. He downgraded just about all the majors. So it was a relative cost downgrade because, remember, those guys own most of banking, way over 90% of all of banking. So it's all a joke. It's a scam.
Hello? I think we lost the audio. Hear myself on the website, but I don't hear you on the phone or on the website. Okay, are you guys still there?
I'm still here.
We had a power failure, and the internet went down, so I had to use alternative methods to call in. Who else is on? I'm here. I'm Brian, and I don't know if anyone else is still here. Okay, yeah, what we had was a little failure, but Brian, I think, was there silence, or did Eric come back in, or?
It's been completely dead except for me
okay.
On the website even.
Okay, no problem. Let me get back in here. And I think I was telling you about the what was happening was that where was I when I left off? If I remember right, you're talking about the banks, their downgrade after the downgrade, higher interest rates on consumers. They're going to blame the federal government for the downgrade and cost us money, and ultimately we're going to pay for it.
Exactly. So, when that occurred, for me it was sort of amusing because I really knew what it meant. I knew that what was actually going to happen was that, in effect, it simply meant another rate hike for us. You know, and guess what? What made me know that I was on the right track was everybody that I heard talking on the news somehow believed that what was going to happen. Eric, are you there now?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, that somehow what happened then would create some sort of a banking crisis the day after. It's funny that I was saying to a friend here, it's like, not really. That won't happen. What will happen is that all our rates eventually are going to be going up.
Egberto, there's a lot of wind noise now.
Yeah, I think that may be you, isn't it?
No, it isn't me.
Okay,
it's not me either. I'm actually in a house.
Okay. I think I got that now. We had a power glitch here, and the whole network went down. Okay, I see my caller from the Skype is here now. My Skype caller, who do I have the honor of speaking to?
This is John.
John, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
All right, come on in, my friend.
I think that before, you know, I think that most of the points that you've made are absolutely legitimate and I agree with, but I think that we have to stop looking at this as being an other situation and look at this as being an us situation. Until we get ourselves together as a democracy, as a republic, as a people, as an intelligent breed of human in the United States of America, nothing is going to change here. Because these people are just going to keep running us around and feeding us. I mean, do you really believe that Trump believes in birtherism? Or is this just a political angle for him to use? Because there's stupid enough people out there to believe this. I mean, George Romney's father was born in Mexico. You didn't hear this then. You hear it now because there's someone dumb enough to buy into it.
John,
and
interesting that you said that. And you also know that McCain was born in my country, Panama.
Yeah, but when you take into consideration the 1934 Law Act, which says that if your parents were born here, one or more parent were born here, you're an American citizen. This all becomes academic. Okay,
right.
And yet people don't know that, and I've told people, you know, who listen to all this crap, and it's like, really? It's like, you know, and then they revert back into it, and I mean, that's just one example, obviously. I'm taking a small example. People do not know what's going on in their own country, and because of it, they're becoming saturated with bad information, and I think it's creating behavior modification that is really slimy.
Right. It's also detrimental to our society. I mean, I am from what folks like to call a third world country. I'm from Panama, Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And what is amazing is I'm going to say something that may sort of get me in trouble with regards to voting. I really think a democracy requires a certain sophistication in a country, in the average population of a country. And what I mean by that is I don't think democracy can really work if you have a completely uneducated population, because immediate belly concerns will always rule. In other words, folks won't have any level of indirections in the way they see things. Okay? So,
I agree.
The United States of America, with a high level of education, lent itself to a pure democracy. However, you get a country that has a lower level of education, a pure democracy doesn't necessarily work. And even America, even though we never articulated such a thing, why I said that kind of stuff could get me in trouble saying that, we never articulated that. We actually promoted that. And if you doubt that, you can actually go and see why did we support Ferdinand Marcos? Why did we support these different dictators? Yes, it's some. It had a lot to do with control. You control one person for a country, it's easier. But it also had to do with people not looking for their best interest. In other words, a lot of people would have, in certain countries, would have felt closer to other governments because other governments were willing to do certain things for them as opposed to having them do things a particular way. So I'm saying even America has acknowledged that that democracy requires a certain amount of the population being fairly educated. Now, what have we done in the United States? In the United States, we've seen a continual decline in the level of education. I've heard things out of people now that simply sounds, made, I hate to just use the word un-American. I don't mean un-American from a patriotic point. I mean, it isn't something that I would have ever thought I would have heard out of the lips of an American. And
yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of stuff that I'm talking about.
You're absolutely right, and you know something, speaking on education, and I mean, it just, again, it brings us back to us. I mean, stop talking about government as if it's something else, it's us. I saw something that absolutely horrified me, and that lady on the bus, did you see that? Pluff or Duff was her name?
Yes, I sure did.
Yeah, And when you look at that, I mean, the whole thing is certifiable, man. From her action to the child's action, the child is going to, you know, rebel against adults because they're, you know, obviously being told what to do and when to do all the time. So, you know, they're going to have those kind of reactions. What did she do? She acquiesced and curled in a corner. You're a grandmother and you can't even, and I feel sorry for her. I understand that she didn't know what to do, but I mean, get up and go get the bus driver, do something. You're supposed to be in charge. When did we lose charge of children? When did we lose the control of the basic necessities of raising a child? I mean, what is wrong here? I mean, obviously, the children shouldn't behave the way they behave, but she's an adult. She should have done something about it. The whole thing is certifiable, and you see more and more of this happen every day. It's like,
you know,
we're restricted as to what we can do with children, so they don't know what to do and blah, blah, blah. But she's a grandmother. How many sets of children has she seen in her lifetime? And yet you can't keep the basics. You know, this is the basic law, okay? You know, hygiene, school, etc. This is the basic law. You can intellectually express. We can have open communication. But come on, man. When did we lose control of children? And we see this going on all the time. How are you going to get educated in such a situation?
There's a word that I can't think of right now. I'm drawing a blank. It's something like being inoculated to things anymore. What is that word? When you've been exposed to something so long that it now you're
desensitized, indoctrinated.
That's the word. No, I desensitized. That's the word. Who said that?
Brian.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
That, I
hey,
mean,
Berta, I want to say one thing. Okay, this guy
ahead.
Brian. John, thanks for calling in as well. John's a regular. I think this might be the first time with Brian. Will you write down his number so that we can get him into our regular rotation of communicators?
Absolutely.
Okay, Brian, thanks so much for your insights, including desensitized.
actually, I got you, Brian. But we have been so desensitized to so much. You listen to what goes on the radio, you listen to all these things, and somehow things are progressively getting to that point where,
Egberto, hold on one second. John and Brian, is Egberto sounding broken up to you guys?
Yeah, he's breaking up on the website.
Okay,
yeah,
am I
so
breaking
Egberto,
up?
Yeah, I think maybe you got to go
not
to
breaking up to me.
Okay, let me go back to my other method. Eric, take over for me for a while.
Okay, sure. Brian, what part of the country are you in?
I live right outside of Nashville.
Oh, awesome. Okay, I was there recently.
Glad to have you.
You know, the thing I wanted to say earlier was that Michael Charney, who is a conservative, some of the same bullying tactics, since John brought up bullying, that are used against basically all Americans who don't identify as Republicans just for not being Republicans, are used. Hey, Brittle, can you mute John for a second, because he's echoing back at me? Those same tactics are used against fact-based Republicans as well, and Michael Charney is a great example. So every time he says something that doesn't fit what Rush Limbaugh or Fox News might say, then he is attacked, and that's why he had that famous Twitter war with Glenn Beck and the Glenn Beck consumers base, consumers. And this is the thing that we're struggling with in the Coffee Party, is that everyone from the moderate right to the independent to the moderate Democrats to liberals, we are all under assault with this bullying language. And Michael Charney said, well, the reason why they do that is that they believe that if they can just destroy all the moderate Republicans, all the independents, all the moderate Democrats, and all the liberals, and have only right-wing extremists in our government, then everything will be better for our country. And the reason why they've come to believe that is something that I would sort of compare to professional wrestling, and that is this notion that there's a them and there's an us, and professional wrestling uses very simple tropes like foreigners are the them, and real Americans, usually white Americans, are the us. They've basically turned Fox News, right-wing radio, and even some elements of journalistic outlets into that story. It's them versus us. And so it's very effective when you want to rule, right? When you just want to be a ruling class, and you need, obviously, there's not enough of a voting base for, I want to be ruled by the 1%. There's not enough people who are going to say that. So you have to tell them it's about something else. And so what the propaganda that the 1% produces will tell you is that you have black people and gay people and Muslim people and immigrants who are trying to take something away from the real Americans. You're the victims, and you need to stand up for the real America. And the only ones who can do that are the 1%. Only your ruling class will try to smash those immigrants, gays, blacks, Latinos, Muslims, all of the bad guys in the professional wrestling show that you watch and actually think is journalism. They will be smashed if we can just push all the moderate Republicans out. Push all the independents out, marginalize all the moderate Democrats, and just hate the liberals so that everybody is afraid to participate and we can rule. But here's where the problem is, and I'll just give you one example. Immigration was brought up by Brian. Egberto is an immigrant to this country.
I'm back.
Coffee Party was founded by Annabel Park, who's an immigrant to this country. When you invest so much media power into making your consumer base, or in this case voting consumer base, hate a group like immigrants, and then it comes to a point where, look, our country is in trouble. We need immigrants in order to revitalize our economy. Every nation that was involved in World War II, Japan, Russia, the whole European Union, the United States, we're all suffering from an impossible demographic challenge right now. The ratio of retirees to workers is going up, 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 because the baby boom generation is retiring, and we are not reproducing at a rate anywhere close to what we did after World War II in this country or in any of those countries. In order
to
compete,
that happening in Japan.
Oh my God, Japan
right
is going to implode.
It's a basket case.
Because Japan, okay, let's just talk about at the scale of, are you a nation of immigrants who welcomes new ideas, new peoples, new entrepreneurs, new job creators to your borders? Or not, Japan is the worst of all the countries I just mentioned. You could be born in Japan, but if your ancestors are Korean, you're not a Japanese citizen. That's how bad it is. So there's just incredible xenophobia there. I love Japan. I've visited Japan. There's so many great things about Japan, but they have some of the same problems we do with xenophobia, but it's even worse. And so Japan is already crumbling because of it. The European Union is, you know, every country is sitting there thinking, do we want to collapse as an economy, or do we want to allow immigrants to come here even though they don't look like us? The United States is actually having that same conversation, except we can't even get there because so much media power has been invested in the last 10 years to make the American people hate immigrants more than they love their country that we can't even talk about the facts of economics and the facts that immigrants coming to this country replenish our workforce, they improve that ratio, they expand our tax base, they create new economic niches, they create jobs. Immigrants have always brought ideas and entrepreneurship and motivation to this country. That's why we've always been the best. And we've basically cast that over in the last 10 years. Why? Because economic royalists needed somebody to hate, and somebody to make their consumers hate. And when the whole war on terror thing started to wear off, when the up and down, yellow, red, and all that stuff started to wear off, when the popularity of the Iraq war started to go down and the popularity of President Bush started to go down, they turned around and they said, who's next? And for whatever reason, they chose immigrants. I think it probably was because President Bush, who today would probably be a rhino, but President Bush, the second President Bush, along with John McCain, who definitely is a rhino, right? He's not allowed to be a Republican anymore because he sometimes speaks in a fact-based way. And Ted Kennedy led the charge to try to pass comprehensive immigration reform in 2005. They had 14 Republican senators, the vast majority of the Senate. They had the votes in the House. But together with a little bit of new media technology, some automated faxes, and some email blasts, about 3% of the United States population, the most hateful people in America, I refer to them as the anti-immigrant lobby, 3% of our population was able to intimidate the House of Representatives into backing down, and we didn't get comprehensive immigration reform in 2005, despite broad bipartisan support. That I think, taught the economic royalist a lesson. That is, look, we're losing on every other front, demographics, this new technology, all these things are going to allow people to organize collectively. We don't like that, right? That's why we hate the unions. That's why we hate government. That's why we hate the internet. We hate anything that allows the people to talk to each other. We want to destroy all of those things. But the only thing we've got left right now is that we've got an older generation of Americans who are used to watching their TV, and we can control what goes on their TV. So let's switch the hate. Let's switch it from Muslims and Arabs. Let's switch it to immigrants right now. Okay, and they thought perhaps it would help them win in 2008. It didn't help them win in 2008, but what it did is it showed that there's still a way to control this government. If you have the economic royalists with their control over media talking to this captive audience of people sitting on their couches, many of them probably homebound, who believe that Fox News is journalism, and many of them probably believe that Rush Limbaugh even is somehow related to the outside world other than that right-wing bubble. And those people are intimidating. They're still they're a minority of the Republican Party, but they're intimidating people into silence or absolute just disgust, as Brian said. They just think the whole process is so corrupt and so partisan. They're basically they're taking over our government with the same tactics as those kids on the bus. So how do we stand up to that? And that's what Coffee Party is trying to figure out. You know, Annabelle prescribed that we stand up to it by being fact-based, courageous, and staying nonpartisan so we don't add to the professional wrestling ugliness, right? So we don't use language that contributes to the angry circus. That was basically the recipe for Coffee Party. It allowed us to have the integrity to pursue the truth wherever it leads us, to follow the truth wherever it leads us, and we found that campaign finance reform, tax code reform, and Wall Street reform were the three issues we needed to focus on. We were talking about that 2 years ago, long before it became part of the national narrative, but we're so grateful that it has. So then now we're getting to all the chips are on the table, right? The Occupy movement essentially was able to open the eyes of the American people to where the chips actually lie, okay? And again, economic royalists don't like it when people can actually organize without their control. right? They love when the Tea Party organized because they could control the narrative through Fox News and Rush Limbaugh. They love when people they can control organize. But when it's out of their hands, as the Occupy movement was, then they take steps. You know, and Egberto was saying earlier that 27 weeks is good for occupying, and it is good when you have 1%, you know, basically directing mayors to end other people, to end the people's right to free speech. So, yeah, it is good because you're talking about people with guns and batons saying no more free speech for you. But I'm sorry I went on this long tirade. But to me, the answer to all of this is, no matter what they do to try to shut down the internet, to shut down union, to try to destroy our government, all the places where we try to communicate with each other as people and deliberate together on what's best for this country, they're trying to, of course, take over the government. But they're all, you know, the internet is under assault, unions are under assault, all of the ways that we try to work together for the common good under assault today. We have to keep innovating. So if they do destroy the unions, Let's organize on the web, as Coffee Party is doing. You know, the government
now
is not going to be destroyed. Yeah. You're back?
Now, we're going to be – yeah, I'm back in. We're going to do all of that. But I have a caller from 630. First of all, I hope folks, they're listening to some of the very specifics that Eric had to say, because this isn't conjecture. This isn't hypothetical. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is what's happening, and – all the, if you look in the aggregate of all our finances or everything, it is all true. Now let me bring in 630. Who do I have the honor of speaking to?
Jeff.
Jeff, how you doing?
Hello.
Jeff?
Good. How about you?
What's your last name, Jeff?
Last name's McKinley.
McKinley.
I'm the guy who's posted some of your stuff out on the site. What I wanted to talk about, if we could turn back to the issue of income inequality. Because basically,
yes,
it's a measurement issue. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Basically, a big component of this is just a measurement issue. And it's due to shifts in the economy and shifts in way different tax laws and, you know, the benefits that people get. One of the aspects of it is that you don't hear much about stock options anymore. And those were used to, you know, reward people within the company, and they were usually pretty large payments, and there would be taxes, capital gains, so those really wouldn't come over into the income side or show up on a tax return until farther down. So that's one thing that is pushing up, you know, the income of the upper earners. At the same time, you have the incomes of the lower and the middle class workers shifting from cash wages to non-cash benefits, such as health insurance and pensions. And anyone who's had to pay, give me one second, I got to switch something here.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah.
And anyone who has, you know, had to pay a health insurance premium knows that this has skyrocketed. I know for my firm alone, that cost has probably doubled. And when that doubles, it impinges on my ability to give more raises. So, but they're getting benefits, but it's just not showing up in their income column. In fact, the Social Security Advisory Board did a study on income inequality, and they said that pretty much the recent increases, quote, can be explained by the rapid increase in the cost of health insurance employee benefits, and that therefore there has not been a significant increase, if any, in inequality of compensation. Now, that isn't Fox News reporting that. That's the Social Security Advisory Board of the United States government.
I need to comment on that so badly. I don't want to interrupt your flow, but that does require some analysis, because I also read that, okay? And I love to see when those numbers come out, because they're cooked. And here's what I mean by they're cooked, because I looked at it. Yes, it is true that a lot more of the compensation, as opposed to going on the income side, is going on the benefit side, and because it goes on the benefit side, it doesn't show up as income. There's a dishonesty in one half of that, and that is companies had started, and this was tax law changes as well, companies had started to actually include, for tax purposes, tax deductions, that part of the health insurance that you pay as income, in fact. Secondly,
No. Wait, we got to stop there. How was that accomplished? How was that accomplished?
It was actually within your wages, okay? Some companies actually used your payments for health care as a part of your wages so that you could get a tax deduction from that. However, so that should be on the ledger is what I'm saying.
I've never heard of that. I've never heard of that. I know that there was in recent legislation.
I had to do that myself. When I worked for NASA, one of the subcontractors for NASA, that's actually how it was done. But
I'm not sure, you know, the point here, if you're a W-2 employee, it would make no sense for the company to push through the health care expense to you because there is no write-off unless you're self-employed.
What I'm saying, the law, the way the law is written is, and we probably shouldn't get into the mechanics of this, but let me just say how it works. If I go ahead and I pay for my health insurance, when I write out my taxes, when I get my W-2 in, that health insurance portion that I pay, the portion I pay, is actually it's actually considered income, and thus I take a tax break on that. The company, likewise, for the portion that they pay, is actually an expense. So there's a whole lot more to that issue that went on mentioned. But secondly, and more importantly, I'm not even concerned about the tax implications that you're speaking about. The part that I'm more concerned about is why are these health care costs going up at a staggering rate over inflation? And I will attest to the fact that the reason for that increase is a transfer of wealth. How? Because of the way it is administered. The way healthcare is administered in our country is nothing more than a transfer of wealth from the middle class. Let me give you specifically how. Specifically when it comes to insurance companies, the mere fact that private insurance companies only disperse on average 70% of that which is collected for healthcare. And secondly, the fact that drug companies are able to get around, because again of policy, get around the patent laws to increase their patents or add one little substance within a pill to get another 17 years of patents, or the fact that doctors are not being paid for outcomes but are being paid for the amount of tests or whatever they can do. I could give you a myriad of things that turns out to be simply a wealth transfer. So when you say the middle class, that there's not a big disparity, I mean, that the if you include all these but if into the, wages plus what did you call it? Wages, not services, but wages plus benefits, somehow the disparity isn't there. No, the disparity is there because that wage that wasn't received was actually put into the pocket of the wealthy. Because who is it that own all these companies that this is being transferred to? The wealthy. So
yeah, but why are insurance payments so high is the issue. And here we get back to policy, just like you're talking about. And, you know, just like you're talking about the drug companies and their patents, this is what we call corporatism, and this is what everybody has to fight. The lifting of mandates, you know, I'm in Illinois, you know.
Jeff. I recognize the statement now. Absolutely. Good talking to you, Jeff.
Yeah, good talking to you. But the reason why insurance is so high, you know, you have 22-year-old males who never smoked in their life, never drank in their life, don't have any intention of doing that. All of these types of things, if they want to go to an insurance company and get insurance, they've got to pay a share of breast implant removals. They've got to pay a share of alcohol rehab, drug rehab, infertility. They have to pay all of these things, which sends their insurance premiums through the roof. You know, the whole idea of it being tied to the employer is from FDR, getting around the wage and price controls. You have no sensitivity to pricing, and you have the government in there dumping buckets of money, just like the housing industry, just like higher education. You have them dumping buckets of money into the system. You're going to get higher prices. It needs to be reformed. You need to get those mandates out of there, and you need to open it up to competition.
I sort of agree with you, but let me tell you where I agree with you. I agree with you where you stated that let me back up. First of all, when you brought in that young man, okay, and that young man having to pay for breast implants, that older woman has to pay for the general immaturity of young people and their record behind the wheel. So, I mean,
No, they don't, because I've got some young kids on my insurance plan, and if I'm the one that's paying it because it's correctly rated, and the person who's incurring the risk or is the risk is paying it. That's not the same, because they are able to charge them a different rate, and it's a much higher rate by multiples, believe me.
No, yes, I know. I have a daughter that is 21 years old now that I paid insurance, and it's a lot higher than what an adult pays. But I guess what I'm saying, insurance, okay? First of all, the part that I completely agreed with you on is that I cannot find a reason why health insurance has anything to do with employers. You're absolutely correct.
Right.
Now, second, where I completely disagree with you is having private insurance in the first place. I think there are certain issues, my morals dictate that there are certain issues that are not for profit, especially if that entity doesn't provide societal value. Let me elaborate on that. An insurance company is nothing more than what I consider a corporate rate, or anyone, or a vulture capitalist, or anyone.
That's a false premise to start with. That's a false premise to start with.
Let me back up. Are you an insurance salesperson at all?
No.
You don't own an insurance company either, right?
Good.
No. All right. I know what you're going to say, which is that insurance companies mitigate risk and they analyze risk and all that kind of stuff. I disagree that we need that in the first place. My contention is a humane society separates what is going to be for profit and what isn't going to be for profit. And when it comes to healthcare, I think healthcare should not be a for-profit venture. Now, yes, it is true that I've supported the current Affordable Care Act simply because that's the best we've got. But I do not believe a humane society can actually claim to be humane when it puts your health care on who can afford it. I think the more humane system would be for us to use our general tax dollars. Everybody has to pay taxes, period. And part of your taxes are towards a general purpose health care. If you want high premium, high care healthcare where you can have all kinds of unnecessary implants or beauty stuff, that's on you. You can buy that kind of insurance if you want to. But basic healthcare should not be placed with insurance companies whose sole purpose is to move money. And the reason they actually have risk management is to bastardize the insurance pool so they can make a profit from that segmentation.
Well, you know, Alberto, that's great.
Yes, sir.
You know, if you want that, and those are your opinions, and those are your values, and those are your priorities, that's mm-hmm. great. Get a coalition together, go to your congressman, and say, look, we want this set up. Caveat to all of this. I don't
Amen.
Want it. I don't want it.
Good.
Don't tax me. Don't force me into it. That's fine. So if you want them to set something up, and it has to pay for itself 100%, don't be taking my money
that.
To do it.
No, but
go ahead and do that. Let me opt out.
Here's
and
a problem.
Get my own
that.
Private insurance.
Jeff, here's a problem. We tried that. Here's how it goes, Jeff. And let's narrate on this a bit. If we had. If folks, and I'm not talking about you personally, but folks who were so scared of that, we had that plan. I wanted a single-payer system, but there were a lot of people like Jeff's out there who said, no, I want to go on my own and get my own private stuff. Hey, I said, fine, that's cool. Here's a problem. We had that mitigated within the law. We said, okay, we'll have that public option in our healthcare system. And all those people who want the benefit of that private insurance, you can go do it, but we have a public option. And you just gave a great narrative for that public option within our Affordable Care Act. However, guess who was scared of that? The same people that you would have bought insurance from were scared. You know why they were scared?
Because the government can undercut them because they don't have the same economic constraints as a private industry does. If someone supplied me with a building, and someone supplied me with a staff, and someone supplied me with a line of credit, and someone supplied me with all of these things, I could chew up the competition like nothing. That's where it becomes. It's got to be a level playing field if you have something like that, and I actually don't know if that's possible.
And Mr. McKinley, let me ask you one thing here, because I think you just made my point indirectly. You're saying that having a single-payer system compete with the private sector has constraints. And of course, then, because doing it single-payer will be that much more efficient, you as a private sector can't compete, for which my answer to you is exactly. You're correct.
No, it can't compete. No, exactly not. I disagree. Is the post office more efficient? They have 80% of their expenses. 80% of their expenses are employee costs, whereas FedEx and UPS are 23 to 40. They're not even 23 to 36.
Yes, and I saw you actually responded to that. You're correct. You just responded to that on a message that I had. I recognize that response.
Sure.
And I had a response for you, but I forgot to put it in. And here's how the response goes.
Yeah.
Our system, our freight, the national freight, has been taken over. All the profitable portion, the less man-intensive portion of our freight movement is taken by private industry. Anywhere that you can move containers, that you can move packages like FedEx and UPS has been handled by our private sector. That is why UPS cannot deliver a piece of mail for 44 cents or 49 cents. So all the labor
I'm not done.
I'll give you a chance to talk. All the labor intensive portion of freight management has been left for the post office. And then after they've left all the man-intensive portion, they said, oh, but look, your labor cost is much higher than ours. Of course, you've taken the most profitable portions of the freight management. You've taken most of express mail. You've taken most of parcel. You've taken the portions that don't require that much away. Go ahead, make your point.
How did they take it? By being more competitive? By being more dependable? The post office can compete just like anyone else, but under the competition, it's going to FedEx and it's going to UPS, it's going to DHL if they're even still in business. It's a level playing field, and the consumer has chosen to go the other way.
Jeff, I don't think it is, but time is kind of limited, and I have another caller that wants to come in. But we need to you need to call in more often, because I love talking to you on these issues. So please call in frequently, okay, my friend?
2 seconds. And they don't deliver first class mail, and only the post office does, because the post office has a monopoly on it. Any other company that tries it would be shut down. It's illegal to deliver first class mail. That's why they have to deliver it.
No, you don't have to call it first class mail, but we talk about that another time, my friend. I really appreciate you calling, sir.
Thank you.
Keep calling. Mm-hmm. Thank you, buddy. Okay, 518, come on in, my friend.
Hi, Alberto. Joe Pomponio up in Albany. How you doing?
Mr. Pomponio, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm enjoying the show, but I was sitting back. I had a few comments I thought I'd make, but the post office had to get involved. So let me get this out real quick. The first class letters are basically constitutional.
Right.
By law, the Constitution says the government must deliver them. Change that FedEx delivers flats. You can put a letter in there for $7.95. A little different than 49 cents. Okay.
Absolutely.
Enough said on that. Enough said on that. With regard to your conversation on the single payer, it's like that is the way to go. This is something that I watched it for 2 years. That's what I thought we'd wind up with, an alternative. And it's somebody with basic care. You get that. You want the bells and whistles, you pay for them. It'll eliminate all the arguments. Okay? So why do Republicans shoot it down? They're the ones that didn't want it in there. Obviously, somebody's paying them off. I mean, you know, I come from an Italian background. I kind of know how this game plays. And, you know, if I'm going to lose money, I'm going to buy somebody that's going to make sure I don't.
Well, you know, Jim, it's simple. It's simple. You cannot. The reality is the numbers are absolute. I wrote that in my book. It's simple. It's it is basic arithmetic that people try to complicate. But a single payer system is simply more efficient. And there's nothing about when they talk about government takeover. It's not true. It was just an imaginary fallacy. Go ahead. Continue. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, that's all right. If we're, I guess, going back to the beginning between conservative and liberal, I kind of, I guess in my own mind, would like the terms done away with. I agree with a lot of the calls. We're all in this together, okay? I'm looking at 20 million people unemployed. If I put 15 million of them back to work, okay, I got taxpayers, okay?
Right.
This is money. How do I get taxpayers who are the real, and I hate this term, job creators? job creators are the people spending the money. Because a customer is going to buy things from an employer when he has money in his pocket.
Absolutely.
We're in a situation that, by my read, going through human history, requires building projects. The Romans did it. The Egyptians did it. The Israelis did it. The Greeks did it. You put people to work. They spend
money. Okay, I'm going to have to cut soon, Jim. You're so right. Give me a final thought because we're running low on time.
I'm glad to be a member of the coffee party and keep it up.
Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure having you. Now, I'd like to get some final thoughts from Brian. Brian, I appreciate you being a first caller. We'll be in touch with you.
Oh, yes, sir. There is so much ground covered. I don't even know where to start, especially with whatever amount of time we got left. I was just thinking,
15 seconds.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. It's been great chatting with you, for real.
Look, I want to tell you, Brian, thank you for what you brought to the show. I hope that you'll come back and talk to us. I really enjoyed having your point of view. And let's go ahead and bring in Eric. Give me some final thoughts, Eric, before we shut this thing down.
It comes down to common good versus profit. So in healthcare, is the purpose of the industry to make profit or to create a healthy, productive country? With immigration, is the purpose to create of law enforcement to create profit? In that case, just create an industry out of incarcerating productive members of society who don't have legal status. If it's for public safety, then have your police officers keeping us safe by preventing us from getting robbed and mugged. It's as simple as that. Is it for profit or for the people?
That could not be said any better. Look here, guys, this has been a great show. I wanted to cover a little bit more about the middle class, whether liberal, conservative, or whatever, a little bit more. But I think we had a libertarian, we had a Republican, we had a left-right call in here. And I think what we could see here is that while we don't agree on everything, there was a lot of agreement among us, which is a good thing. We are the average Americans here talking and getting solutions and trying to find solutions. And as you can see, we could do this without going down anybody's throat. If we stay talking long enough, we'll find a solution. This is Politics Done Right. I'm McBurto Willis. I want to thank Brian Eric, for always being there for us out here. I want to talk Jim. I want to thank Jim.
It's Joe.
I want to talk
Joe.
Joe Pampagno. I want to thank Michael for calling in and all the callers that I've forgotten. We had a great show. Thank you very much, and you guys have a wonderful Saturday. Remember, you must be engaged. Being in politics should be a requirement for citizenship. Thank you. See ya.